Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting are Caroline White, Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. Stick around a little later, you'll hear Charlotte's interview with Alexandra Gould, who is an artist. But Charlotte, why don't you tell us a bit more about that interview?
Sure. Well, I don't want to spoil it for you, but essentially she's the artist who went on the Five Deeps mission. We've spoken about this on the podcast before. It was this incredible venture to go to the five deepest points of the ocean. And I don't know if anyone has ever had her job before. And it was one of those fortuitous things where she was just super interested in the project. So she was tracking the boat and talking to the scientists just out of interest, basically, to do with what they were discovering. And one day they said, well, why don't you come join us? So she went on board for 2 weeks and sort of did various sketches and took photographs and then came back and started creating artworks, not only for the people involved on the trip, but sort of the crew have bought these prints. Some of them are huge, some of them are tiny. But the thing that I found particularly interesting is I sort of said to her, well, how do you do art on board? And she basically said, you can't, it's impossible because you miss what's happening. You miss the briefings and there's really serious scientific work going on. And if you're sitting there with a paintbrush, you're going to get in all kinds of trouble. So essentially while she was on board, it was her job to sort of soak up the atmosphere. And then she had to go home and try and put that to paper. So it wasn't just about painting what was in front of her. It was about saying, okay, how do I capture what it was like in the pitch black in the bottom of the submarine? Or what it was like when we first discovered this incredible thing and there was all this chaos on deck because people were so excited. But I love the concept of having an artist on board to capture your adventure. It tells such a different story to a photograph, which are obviously amazing to have as well. But I hope we'll see a lot more of her. Anyway, she's a lovely lady and she tells us all about it later on.
Fantastic. So stick around to hear more from Alexandra. And actually, the interview you did, Charlotte, with Victor Vescovo, the owner of the DSSV Pressure Drop, is the owner of that boat, and that was the boat that did the Five Deeps expedition. So the interview you did with him is on the homepage of the website now, so please go and check it out. He truly is one of the world's most fascinating people. This guy is a real explorer and adventurer. Great story. In other news, the February issue of the Boat Boat International is out now. This issue always seems like it takes an age to appear on the newsstands, mainly because we put most of it together before Christmas, which already seems like a long, long time ago. But it's a really great issue. We have 95-meter Opari on the cover, and other boats in the issue include the amazing research vessel Ocean Explorer, the Mazu Yachts 82, and the new Pocket Explorer K584. And Charlotte, another one of your story about Ocean Dreamwalker 3 and its tour of Alaska is in there too. There's also a story about modding your boat for long-term occupation, as many owners are doing. They're spending a lot more time on their boat. So if you are doing that, this is a great resource for you to kind of tweak your boat slightly to make it more comfortable for long-term occupation. And we also feature all the world's best heli-skiing destinations and meet the superyacht designer transforming a classic French chateau.
I love that. That was Tim Gosling, probably known to many yacht owners out there, but he's taken on this huge property in France. And I mean, every interior story we do, they say, oh, it was a massive project. It was bigger than we expected. We had to put in heating. But this one is enormous. It's sort of 20 levels beyond grand designs. I think he's a brave man for taking it on. I think it's the kind of thing that's going to take a lifetime, but the most beautiful building. If you're looking for some property porn and you're not the person actually taking it on, it's well worth having a look at.
Actually, he's got a really interesting Instagram page as well called Restoration Chateau, which he puts updates on daily, almost daily, with great captions. So have a look at that too. I follow him, and it's just really interesting to see it's a massive, like you said, what an undertaking. It is an enormous task what he's doing. But read the story for yourself and see what he's taken on. It's a great one. So how about this for some news? In 2020, US boat sales reached a 13-year high. How about that? How counterintuitive is that? Everyone's locked down, but boat sales reach a 13-year high. That's according to the National Marine Manufacturers Association, which reports that 310,000 recreational craft were sold in 2020, up 12% on 2019 and reaching levels not seen before the global financial crisis. And it's just amazing. And it certainly reflects the anecdotal things we've been hearing about smaller boats flying off the shelves. So when people could get on the water, they were doing it with gusto and buying boats in great numbers. I should caution that these figures do not include super yachts. They're mainly smaller craft, but still, what a result. And we've got a quote here from the president of the NMMA, Frank Hugelmeier. And he says, 2020 was an extraordinary year for new powerboat sales as more Americans took to the water to escape pandemic stress and enjoy the outdoors safely. And I just wanted to highlight a few other figures. So in 2020, the total value of US sales of boats, marine products and services was $47 billion. An estimated 100 million Americans go boating every year. And 95% of boats on the water in the US are less than 26 feet. So that just reinforces the point that they're smaller boats. But, you know, it doesn't matter how big your boat is. Just being able to get out on the water makes all the difference. So there you go. Bumper year for small boat sales in the US. Phenomenal performance, really.
And we do know that smaller boats, people who buy smaller boats go on to buy larger and larger boats. So it's for the future, a good thing for the larger yacht industry.
Too right. Well, here's hoping. Out and down in Auckland, lovers of the America's Cup will know that the Prada Cup has begun. So the Prada Cup decides. This is the three-way series between Luna Rossa, Ben Ainslie Racing, or rather Team Ineos, and American Magic, the New York Yacht Club's effort to take back the cup. So those three teams will be racing, and the winner of the Prada Cup will go on to face Emirates Team New Zealand in the America's Cup finals, which start in March.
Yeah, Ben Ainslie has written a column for our March issue, Ben Ainslie of Ineos Team UK, about the battering that his team took during the America's Cup World Series, both on the water and in the press. It's interesting to read about the extreme psychological strain that it's put on his team. He's actually had to tell them to stop reading the news to protect them.
Gosh. Wow. Yeah. I mean, there's the pictures coming. I mean, these boats are so extreme now. And I think it was one of them went over the other day. Oh, God, I can't remember which one it was. But they are wild craft and operate at extreme speeds. So not just the physical stress and the stress of, you know, constant danger effectively being out on the water. The team was getting a bit of a peppering in the press as well. So, yeah, probably not a bad thing that they've stopped reading the news.
Well, I had a bit of interesting news the other day, actually. I was speaking to Ocean Independence this week. They've had a good year for sales. Like others, I think it's been a bit of a challenge. But they were telling me how much of a shortage there is on the charter market for the coming year or so, which I guess when you think about it, makes total sense. You know, as soon as things are sort of back to normal, in quotes, people want to get out there, but owners want to get out there as well. So they want to be on their boats. So owners who are normally chartering theirs out are deciding to keep them for themselves, and who can blame them? And strong sales, obviously a good thing, but also mean that potential charter boats being taken offline. And add to that the fact that boats are being moved around, owners may be bringing their boats closer to them. You've got a market where demand is far, far outstripping what's available on the market. So maybe a nice problem to have, but it is a problem. And if you were hoping to go on a charter in the coming months, year, couple of years, I'd get on it straight away, to be honest. They said that they've seen the most demand for the Western Med, far above everything else. So all the normal places, south of France, Balearics, Corsica, Sardinia, and then quite a lot of interest as well in Greece and the Eastern Med, but not so much in Croatia, largely because they don't have the boats there to charter out. But I think Croatia is one of the places I always find quite interesting, that I think it's a bit chicken and egg. You know, owners that go there rave about how wonderful it is. Having been there myself, I can absolutely attest that it's beautiful and a wonderful place to be. But it doesn't necessarily have all the infrastructure that people want at the moment in terms of kind of amazing restaurants and glamorous hotspots to hang out with other yacht owners. But if people don't go there, I'm guessing that's, you know, that's going to take a while to develop. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about why it hasn't sprung up. I feel like every year it's mentioned as the hot new place to go, and every year it doesn't quite top the list.
I think what you said is true, basically. I mean, if you want to base your charter boat out there, you've got to make sure you're going to get a kind of 10, 12 weeks of charter on your boat or whatever. So if people aren't sure that's going to happen, they're not going to move their boat there. And so you can't develop a market there if the boats aren't there. So it's exactly what you said. It's chicken and egg. It's a bit risky basing your boat out there and hoping you get the charter interest. So I suspect that means it's going to remain a fairly small market for a while. I mean, why wouldn't you? If you owned a big popular charter boat, why would you take the risk? If you knew you were going to get 12 weeks in the Western Med, why on earth would you move it out of the Western Med? Unless you particularly personally wanted to go and cruise Croatia and use a bit of chartering, come over there as a good excuse to do that. Yeah, so chicken and egg, like you said.
Well, hopefully it will develop independently for other tourism reasons, and that will sort of kickstart things. But always one to watch, and always one that's sort of so close to being a really big hit, but not quite. Anyway, the other thing I've been doing, it almost doesn't feel like work, I've been doing over the past few days, is our back page column, The Bitter End, which is something that always gives me a real chuckle. It's basically sort of anonymous stories sent in by owners. So anyone could send them in. Actually, we sometimes accept stories from captains and crew members as well. You can email us at thebitterend@boatinternationalmedia.com or drop one of us a WhatsApp, Instagram message, Facebook, however you want to reach out. But I've had some real crackers coming in that will be appearing in various issues coming up. And it reminded me, my absolute favourite one of all time was, there was a story which I think actually happened in Croatia, where there was a captain who had complained that their new stewardess was particularly lazy and they weren't pulling their weight and they wanted to get rid of them. And the owner was a really fair guy. And he said, well, you know, I'm not sure about that. Can you give me any examples? And he sort of said, well, you know, she's just a bit of a slacker. And he said, okay, one of the things she does is, instead of hoovering the carpet when you're off, you know, off at night going for dinner, she's worked out that instead of dragging the hoover around, she can just detach the stick and drag that across the carpet, and that will make the telltale lines that most yacht owners look like. So he hung back one night, he kind of made out like he was going off for dinner, didn't actually get in the tender, hung back on board, and he witnessed her just dragging the stick around. And when he said, you know, what are you doing, she sort of said, so he said he wanted to let her go, and she was very upset because she said, oh, well, I'm distracted at work at the moment because my grandmother's very ill and, you know, she's about to pass away, and she lives in, I think it was Lithuania. So he said, okay, well, I'm still going to let you know, but good news, I can get you flights to Lithuania. And she said, why do I want to go to Lithuania? I want to go to Corfu. Which I also thought was quite good. So, but we get everything from pirates to people being bribed at customs or asking for bribes at customs to people destroying their boats on the first turn by trying to be cocky enough to part them themselves. If you have any tales, drop me a line and I'd love to hear them.
I almost admire the chutzpah of that stewardess.
Yeah.
Too lazy to hoover the carpet or vacuum the carpet, so she just dragged lines into the carpet to make it look like it was hoovered. And then when the owner offered to fly her back to Lithuania to see her ailing grandmother, she said, no, can you fly me to Corfu instead? I mean, that is unbelievable.
It's amazing. The commitment to the line.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It's almost easier just to hoover the carpet than to detach the thing and, you know, just hoover the carpet. It's amazing.
I mean, to me, it's the sign of someone who has checked out. You're not loving your job at that stage, I don't think.
No, amazing. Anyway. Yeah, so there's a raft of these stories. And actually, we're going to be getting more and more of them online. That's right, isn't it, Charlotte? We're going to be putting our Bitter End stories online so a bigger audience can enjoy them. But just to reinforce that point, if you do have a great story like that, if you are a super yacht owner or know of a brilliant story, tell it to us anonymously, thebitterend@boatinternationalmedia.com. And Charlotte will be in touch. Alrighty, on to this week's news. Caroline, walk us through it.
Well, to start off with it, we have some rather sad news. Fraser has announced the death of its founder, David L. Fraser, who passed away on the 6th of January, aged 99. He launched Fraser in 1947 and quickly expanded the company to sites in Newport Beach, San Diego, San Francisco, Seattle, and Florida during the 1960s. Described as a passionate sailor from an early age, David began crewing on the schooner Anna R. Heidritter at school, and the yacht remains Fraser's emblem to this day.
Legend of the business. Yeah. Our thoughts, obviously, to the whole Fraser family.
Absolutely. In happier news, Wally has revealed an eye-popping new 27-metre motor yacht design named Y200. Set to debut at the Ferretti Group Private View in Monaco this September, the Y200 was designed by Wally founder Luca Bassani with the Ferretti Group's in-house engineering department. And the idea is really maximizing space. So the Ferretti Group says it boasts 50% more living space than other yachts of this size. That adds up to 200 square meters of living space throughout the design, including a 22 square meter upper deck interior and a 100 square meter main deck interior. There's also a 37 square meter owner's suite at the bow with far-reaching ocean views thanks to wraparound glass. And the exterior space has been maximized too, with a beach club that expands using fold-out wings.
Every time I see a new design and I think, that's it, they cannot possibly put more volume into a boat of that length. Someone else designed a boat like the Y200. And you think, oh my, how is it? I mean, it is just an exercise in space cramming. And they're kind of, I don't know where to draw the line between aesthetics and volume anymore. It seems to me, I mean, it's a remarkable looking boat. I think it's a bit of an acquired taste. But Luca Pisani is nothing if not an innovative, forward-thinking guy. So it's quite possible that he's, all the Wally marketing is 20 years ahead. So maybe that's what this is. Maybe it's just, this is the boat 20 years ahead of its time. But it is an exercise in every square inch is packed into this platform. Amazing looking thing.
Absolutely. And from my point of view, it's always interesting to see somebody do something new and interesting and different. Obviously, if I were buying a yacht, maybe I would prefer something slightly more traditional, but that's a personal taste thing. And I think designs like this push the envelope a bit and perhaps will influence other designs in the future, which is a good thing.
Well, that's it. I mean, you buy this boat from the inside out. I think that's what you walk on. You might not love how it looks, but then you walk onto the boat and you think, oh my, this is incredible. This is a 40 meter boat in a 27 meter package. Was it 27 meters?
Yeah.
How big was it? Yeah, 27 meters. Yeah, so so I think that's it. It's all about the wow when you get on board. You think, oh, how is this even possible? And I think for the price against a much bigger, much longer boat, I get it. But it'd be interesting to see how the market responds.
Absolutely. So the last piece of news I've got for you this week is that Tankoa Yachts is in the final stages of diligence to acquire the Cantieri di Pisa shipyard. The purchase of the 76-year-old yard would allow Tankoa to expand and also take advantage of Cantieri di Pisa's range of 30 to 45-metre products.
Yeah, we mentioned Tankoa in last week's podcast on a bit of a roll at the moment and recently picking up a World Superyacht Award too, and now they're expanding further. Yeah, so good on Tankoa. Cantieri di Pisa, of course, really a pedigree historic yard. So that'll be interesting to see how that expands their offering to the market.
Absolutely.
So last week we talked about full year brokerage figures. This week we're talking about full year delivery figures. Caroline, you've been digging into the Boat Pro stats with Raphael. Tell us more.
Absolutely. So there were 349 yachts of 24 meters or more delivered in 2020 compared to 359 in 2019. So a difference of only 10. And if you're wondering whether 2020's yachts were much smaller, the answer is not on average. The yearly average was exactly the same as 2019 at 33.9 meters. The biggest delivery was actually bigger than the biggest delivery in 2019. So 2020's biggest delivery was 140-meter Scheherazade versus 136-meter Flying Fox in 2019. In none of the size brackets that we cover was there a massive year-on-year difference. The biggest disparities, and they're not very big, were in the mid-size boats. So the 30 to 40-meter category, there were 92 deliveries in 2020 versus 100 in 2019. And in the 40 to 50-meter bracket, there were 30 deliveries in 2020 versus 35 in 2019. In terms of nations making those deliveries, Italy is predictably at the top of the league table in terms of both the number and total length delivered. And it has an even bigger market share than in 2019. So it made 205 deliveries in 2020 compared to 180 in 2019. The UK, which was number two in 2019 with 56 deliveries, only delivered 27 yachts, super yachts in 2020. To echo what we said last week about the brokerage market, this is an astonishing achievement for the world's yards, fighting to keep deadlines during a very difficult year. This year, I'm reliably informed by our resident data genius, Raphael Montagnier, that we can expect the same level of deliveries, as well as the launch of no fewer than six yachts of more than 100 meters.
Thanks, Caroline. So that's interesting, isn't it? So compared to last year, there was only a difference of 10. Sorry, compared to 2019, there was only a difference of 10. So 359 super yachts delivered in 2019, 349 super yachts delivered in 2020. Okay, yeah. To echo what Caroline said, great effort from the world shipyards to keep so many boats on track. Right, that's it for this week. Thank you, Caroline. Thank you, Charlotte. Stay tuned for Charlotte's interview with Alexandra Gould.
So joining me today is artist Alexandra Gould. Now, Alexandra isn't any artist. She's an expedition artist, and she was specifically the individual who was chosen to join the incredible Five Deeps expedition that was fronted by entrepreneur Victor Vescovo. So, Alexandra, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Where are you? Presumably not on a boat, presumably in the UK?
Yeah, in Wiltshire. Can't get much more inland, really, in the UK. So, yeah, pursuing my art projects and keeping in contact with people that I've met on the expedition. It's a new year, so it's a chance to catch up and see what everyone's up to.
Absolutely. So let's start off talking a bit about your background, because I can't imagine what sort of CV qualifies you to be an expedition artist. What was your path into art to start off with?
Not conventional. I went through business and advertising and worked in fashion and events before committing to be an artist sort of full time, and then taking commissions. And I've really been a portrait artist predominantly for the last 5 years, working with clients who want to capture the way someone works or the personality that they want to see embodied in something other than photography or film.
So really you're a specialist in kind of capturing a moment or kind of conveying the life of something.
Yes, the storytelling element behind a person, their personality, maybe their motivations, that's very much come through my previous portraits. And then actually I was very interested in pursuing, alongside the commissions, works that really interested and intrigued me about climate change and about our oceans. So in fact, I was in contact and collaborated with Dr. Alan Jameson, who is the chief scientist aboard the Five Deeps expedition. And I was really interested in working with him and his research and discoveries around persistent organic pollutants and the plastics that are being found within deep sea organisms in the Hadal Zone. So that there's a sort of gradually from portraiture of people and storytelling there, it moved on to being about deep sea creatures and what their story is and how we perceive them.
That's fascinating. So presumably you hadn't had much experience of the yacht world before then. You were kind of looking at it from a sort of ocean conservation angle, or had you done?
No, I hadn't. I mean, I grew up in Southend, so an albacore dinghy was the extent of my ocean going, you know, on the estuary. So not at all. But actually, I find that what's the strongest part of this expedition, coming at it from my perspective, is that there's a lot of motivation, there's a lot of ambition. It's very much a story. And in previous centuries, if there was an expedition, it would have a huge amount of energy and excitement and be very newsworthy even before it sets off. So it's that element of storytelling about what motivates not only the key people involved and everyone else who has to work so hard to bring these things together. So there is very much a very compelling story behind that, as well as the science. And yeah, there's a lot to get your teeth into as an artist, a lot to observe.
And so how did you know, you were having conversations with Alan before. Did it just naturally develop that you would join them when the exhibition took place, or was there a kind of formal process whereby other artists applied? How did you actually kind of get the gig?
It was very serendipitous. I had been obviously chatting about the pollutants and the plastic and the sea creatures that Alan is involved with. And he mentioned that he was chief scientist, something that was in the pipeline, very exciting coming up. And I learned about the expedition just as it was setting off over Christmas, I think December 2018. And I was fascinated. I'm watching that, what I thought, with this live update on exactly where they were tracking them, as they're crossing, traversing the oceans, and how deep the submersible was. And this is all really exciting. And I get in contact with Alan, and it's only later I realised there was a delay on those figures. You know, it wasn't actually live. They were very, very excited, thinking, oh, I've got to get back to the computer and have a look how they're doing. So then he came back and was, you know, he was interested that I was interested in the expedition and suggested that it would be a really valuable part of, not necessarily a valuable part of the team, but a really useful person to have on board amongst the media and the film crews and the journalists to have this different perspective. And really fortunately, the whole of the expedition team backed that and agreed for me to come on board with just a view of my portfolio beforehand, with the word of Alan to recommend me. So I met Victor for the first time on the pressure drop in just off the Kingdom of Tonga. That was my first experience.
And how much notice did you have for it? Was it a case of, okay, you know, come next week? Or did you have a while to let it all sink in and start thinking about how you might approach things?
Yeah, I had a couple of months to think about it. And, you know, I mean, obviously I responded within like minutes. Yes, of course, I want to do this. But then sort of digesting that as someone who hasn't travelled a lot, to suddenly be going not only just into another hemisphere, but, you know, it's 12-hour different time zones. So it's still 12 o'clock, but it's now in the middle of the night, and it's a completely different set of stars and a completely different environment to find yourself in. So it was really exciting and completely it's like your own adventure. You're very much coming aboard the whole process as an onlooker with all that excitement and awe, which perhaps if you're intimately involved in an expedition, you're busy working. You don't necessarily you know, get that vibe. So
don't have time to let it all sink in.
Yeah, yeah.
And so let's talk a bit about, so what was the bulk of your work on board? Sort of what sort of things were you painting, sketching? What was your sort of day-to-day?
I thought I'd better take all these sketchbooks. I only had a little backpack. So I take all this stuff, and I won't take paints, but I'll take pencils and charcoal and find ways of working with my camera, because I hadn't done it before. There isn't an expedition artist that I could find to relate to and ask them questions. And actually, when it came to it, the best thing was observing and using the camera. And the few sketches I did sort of commit to sitting and working on were a bit of a disaster. I was supposed to be in a welcome meeting. It was like my first opportunity to really meet everybody, the whole team. It's a deep, you know, proper a briefing meeting as soon as you get on the vessel. And I'm just sitting on top deck sketching some aspects of the ship. And I completely missed it. And it was dreadfully embarrassing, because obviously I wanted to be there. And it's that moment where you realise this isn't an artist's experience. This is, I have to go and watch and see as much as I possibly can and record it, both in how I'm feeling and in these photos. And sketching and doing art on board, I would have been missing stuff. It's just, yeah. It just happens all too quickly, and you're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
A very new way of working then, really, sort of different to how you would approach things normally.
Yeah, it's like reading a book. You can think about it afterwards, but you at the time you just have to immerse yourself in it and make sure you're watching and taking notes. Some of it for me is sketching, but a lot of it is about talking to people and watch people interact and the landscape. I mean, there really is everything from where people choose to take their cigarette breaks and have time out to being in the comms room where there's loads of tensions and you're watching people work so very hard on problem solving, and it's that interplay of people and what they're striving to achieve, and it's absolutely fascinating, but you do have to watch. You can't go sketch on deck, you miss it
so
all.
Really, you were what you're trying to do is capture the atmosphere and the important moments in the landscape, rather than necessarily looking at the kind of the specimens that they were bringing on board. Or was there a bit of that as well?
Oh yeah, I mean, as soon as the landers, scientific landers come on board and the specimens are there, you know, as soon as I can get out there, you know, with the hard hat, and I can just watch, and I don't want to get in their way. It's not that I want to take part, but I do want to see exactly what they're bringing in and how they're dealing with it. And the fact that, you know, the experience in Tonga in the Pacific, where it's nice and warm, the rate at which people work and the specimens, how they're coming out the water, is very different to when I was up in just off the western coast of Svalbard, and it's freezing cold and it's really late at night, and they're having to work incredibly hard under these bright spotlights. It's all of those little things. You have to be there to watch it and observe. For instance, when I was watching Alan, the chief scientist, doing his work of bringing in the sample, and I'm looking at a fish that's the wrong, you know, the funny way up, and it's big cut for samples for DNA sampling. And I'm very aware that Alan isn't looking at the fish. He's already several steps ahead, working out what he's going to do with this, where the information is going to go, what his, you know, he's just in a different mental space. So that's, again, that's something you get by looking, because if I take a photo, it just looks like Alan's leaning over a sample of a fish. You have to kind of be part of watching it, and it was brilliant. And there isn't always the adrenaline either, because as an outsider, it's so exciting, and I'm sort of quite awestruck to be there and be part of this, and everyone's very, very calm. Because that's what they've trained, that's what they've been working towards. This is a very safe, very considered, this isn't like put together with a few days' notice. This is relentless planning for months and months on end. So that's also quite interesting, you know, that I'm the one that's fizzing and bubbling, and everyone else is just very calm and contained.
And how long were you on board then, and sort of what happened? What were the next steps with those, you know, what you'd observed once you got home?
Just over a week for both trips, and very extremely different trips, Pacific and Arctic. So it's a case of going through sketchbooks, making notes when I get back. I had already, between the trips, I had started to make more sketches and paintings, working with acrylics and oil paints, and then actually coming back from the trip, working very quickly with charcoal, just to try and get a sense of the landscape. And the landscape was an aside. I mean, there's when we're in the Arctic, there's this amazing ocean life, but that wasn't, although it was a scientific endeavour and it was an expedition and an endeavour to go to the deepest reaches of the oceans, my experience was very much about the people, the machines, the logistics, and the tensions or not on board the vessel. So I was finding I took a few sort of photos, I mean, nowhere near as good as the people on board who are doing this amazing photography with their amazing lenses. And, you know, I'm just rocking up and taking a few shots, and the sketches of the wildlife that I did were just sort of inconsequential, actually, because there was something much, much bigger at stake. And that really came across in the feeling of the expedition. This wasn't about one fish or, you know, look, there's some amazing smelly walrus over there, and they were, you know, that all, oh, that was fantastic, but there's something much, much bigger, much, much more epic going on an expedition like this.
I was going to say, how many pieces came out of this in total then? Was it a question of just handing all your sketchbooks and things over, or were there a set number of pieces that you were sort of commissioned to create at the end of the day? What was the sort of end result from both of the trips?
It's really, really fluid. I found Victor and EOS and Triton to be very, very flexible in what their expectations of me. So actually, I haven't committed to doing a particular number of pieces, but it's in fact something that I'm still working on now, and I will continue working on over the next few years. Commissions I've done and completed for Victor and for Patrick of Triton, and I've done a series of prints, both from lino cuts and also from the acrylic paintings that I've then gone on to sell. Some of those prints are actually a really nice way to make art more affordable for members of the crew who don't necessarily want to be commissioning paintings. But it's not so much a memorabilia, but because you've got, you're capturing a story in a painting, that to have a print of that and their achievement, it's all kind of bound up together. So the work will continue. I've got, at the moment, I've got a partner painting that I'm working on, having done one piece of work that was set with the deep submersible support vessel on the surface of the ocean, and the limiting factor, the deep submersible vessel just within the ocean. So I want to do and planning a painting at the moment where that's actually a scientific lander within the ocean, and it's the back of the support vessel. So you can see all these tremendous cranes and the hangar for the limiting factor submersible. And it's kind of the work, it evolves because you kind of remember a feeling or a moment in time or someone. Sometimes someone looks at a piece of work and goes, oh yeah, I remember that, or it's really nice that you've included members of the crew who weren't actually interviewed for anything, and your stories evolve and the artworks get bigger, I mean physically bigger as well, so I've got to kind of try and contain that.
And can you remember, I mean, it must have been quite a nerve-wracking moment, sort of being selected for the project the way you were and having a very open brief, the sort of first pieces of your work that you submitted, that must have been slightly nerve-wracking. Did it feel that way, or had you spent enough time together that you felt pretty confident that they'd be pleased with what you'd done?
It's a bit of a weird one because I'm quite confident I can deliver. It's just, I know that I can observe something accurately and represent it properly. And it's possible that people don't like my style, but in which case, you know, they already knew what my style would be to a point. So I wasn't anxious about whether the work would be well received. It's more a case of, is there anything I'm missing? Is there anything you wanted from this experience that I haven't yet delivered? And it's that sort of toing and froing where when I create a painting, for instance, for Victor, it was very much, you know, this is how I'm seeing it and experiencing this image of you aboard your vessel and your accomplishments. And is there anything you feel that isn't encapsulated there? And that it's a series of emails and photos, and I'm pretty flexible with working with whatever the client wants to get out of it, whilst also holding on to that initial idea, which comes very much from my observation.
And It all sounds so fascinating. I mean, we hear of owners a lot having, especially if they're doing these amazing adventure trips to Alaska or the Northwest Passage, you know, it's not uncommon for people to have a sort of National Geographic type photographer on board or a videographer. But what you're describing is something quite different in that it's not documenting what something looks like. It's sort of capturing the essence and the feelings and the emotion, really. Do you think this is something that could become more common, that more people will want to do, or did it feel like a one-off project?
It would be fantastic if more people took to the idea of it, because it is about the atmosphere, it is about that emotion, and it tells a bigger story, and art does that. But people will find perhaps their own way. For instance, it's not just an artist, a musician or a writer might take something on board. For some people, perhaps having an article written, you know, that kind of sums it up for them. I do think that art is really good, though, at conveying not only the story and those motivations or that excitement, whatever it was that was going on that vessel, on that moment, giving that back to the client, but also it allows the client to then share that with colleagues or family, or anyone moving forward. You know, it's art has this very special space that sort of transcends time, and you look back at it and you see something new, and it relates a story. That's kind of the point. And there's a phenomenal photography, and I love photography. It's not something that I consider myself very good at doing, but I see stuff and I want to capture it, and I think photography is absolutely phenomenal for that. But I think it works alongside art, and and you don't have as much, you know, or you might have one or two piece artworks about an expedition or about a voyage or a trip that's, you know, that trip of the life of a lifetime. Whereas you might have hundreds of photographs and you'll select maybe 50 that really typify that that trip. They're not really exclusive of each other.
Presumably, people can get in touch with you. If people are listening to this and thinking, you know what, this is the woman I want to come with me when we go to the, you know, the Caribbean next year or whatever, presumably you're sort of open to inquiries, or are you really only interested in more sort of scientific, sort of ocean conservation type journeys?
No, I mean, definitely, if anyone wants to contact me, that's fantastic. I mean, I really like collaborating with someone, and that was what was so lovely about Victor and his team, is that it's a shared process, you know, and it allows people to explain what they want to get from that. I am very interested in conservation and the ocean and everything from the Rev Ocean vessel and what's going on with this dynamic change in the way people are behaving towards the ocean and their vessels. But equally, seeing these beautiful, elegant sailing yachts, and that's completely a world away, with all these tiny details that's so well thought through and crafted, and the architecture that goes into it. I mean, there's so much to see, and I do find myself drawn to use portraiture. It's not just of people, as I said, it's people, it's fish, but it's also machines. And a lot of my work on this was the beauty of the vessel, the pressure drop. She was very unique. She was really heavily engineered, but with beautiful little details. So there's so much out there. I think it's just about finding the right person to work with, the, you know, the client and their team.
And I know that this is probably an impossible question, but I just wonder, I mean, I've seen the portrait you've done of Victor. I've obviously not been on board Five Deep, so I can't attest to that. But, you know, to me, you capture, from when I've interviewed him, you captured what I sort of felt speaking to him and seeing him so brilliantly. But which image are you most proud of that you've done so far, and how long did it take you?
Oh, thank you. I'm pleased you like the Victor portrait.
It's fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, that's the really strong Five Deeps expedition portrait, because it all stemmed from that man, you know, his ambition and drive and his restlessness, which you kind of get a sense from the portrait, the land, the layers, this complex, but the sky is restless. There's these ladders going up out of the image, and yet that was physically where he was sat, and there's a certain tension there, and I think that is what this particular expedition has continued to move forward. It wasn't enough to do just the five deepest points of our oceans. They've done the Ring of Fire. They're continuing to move onwards, and that's really, really exciting. So I don't know what other pieces of works, although I'm proud of them, they're different. They're different because they're about a different aspect. Sorry, I'm getting a bit lost with the question. I mean, I'm kind of proud of all of them. That one particularly, that's Victor. That's the expedition. What do you look back on 100 years and go, oh, yeah, that's Victor Vescovo, and he did this and he achieved that, and he has a lasting legacy because he didn't stop, you know, and he kept on with new ambitions.
Absolutely. Well, it's a beautiful portrait. But my very last question is, we're in lockdown here in the UK, as many people are all over the world, and obviously miles from the beautiful waters of Tonga. What are you painting at the moment?
At the moment, I'm working on this partner painting, which is of the back of the vessel and all the heavy steelwork that's involved. And I'm also still developing my lino portraits of as many of the crew that I managed to capture, because that's, for me, that's kind of the epic film poster of this expedition, which I haven't yet compiled. But that's really exciting. It's a nice New Year project because it's something I've already started. So in lockdown, it's quite difficult sometimes to find inspiration. But pursuing something you love is quite a pleasure and easy to do.
Well, I hope you'll give us a little preview of them when you feel you're near the end. Thank you so much, Alexandra. It's been lovely talking to you, and good luck with the rest of the pieces.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
That's it for this week. Thank you for listening to Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.